Hi, this is the audio version of the video review of Mad Men. If you'd like to watch the video with me lurking around saying exactly the same things, but with pictures, then you can find that on my YouTube channel, The Flicks the Church Forgot. If you'd rather listen to the audio of that, that's coming your way now. Whichever version you listen to, I hope you find it interesting. Thank you. Hi everyone. Yeah, I'm out in the middle of the woods because tonight we're going to be looking at a fantastic slasher movie from 1982, which has just recently been released by Arrow Blu-ray. By Arrow on Blu-ray. And this film is, of course, Mad Men, which is an misunderstood film. A lot of people aren't really into it, but I think it's great. And so tonight, join me as we get lost in the woods, being chased by a homicidal farmer in the film Mad Men from 1982.
You must not say his name above a whisper, for he can be anywhere, anytime. And if he hears you say his name, he will come. And when he finds you, there is no escape. There is no place on earth you can hide. Mad Men from JF Pictures, rated R.
Now, in the extras on the new Arrow video disc, Mad Men's producer Gary Sayles makes a great point. He says something like, the slasher film craze lived fast, died young, and left a beautiful corpse. It's a perfect way of describing a subgenre of horror that became so rampant in a short period of time, then died away, and yet it still remains very much loved and imitated decades later. Now, I'm not going to go into any sort of big depth analysis of the slasher genre in general. If you want that, then check out episode 65 of my audio podcast, where I discuss slasher films, karma, and the punishment of sin. Yeah, bizarre title. But I'll be looking specifically tonight at Mad Men, which came out in 1982. This was a year when the slasher movie craze had really hit its peak. Both major and minor studios were eager to put slashers out, hoping to recreate the phenomenal business Friday the 13th was doing for Paramount. And in amongst this literal avalanche of slasher films was one of the first of 1982, a film that seemed to be overshadowed by many of the other big slasher franchises, and yet a film that has not only endured, but has become one of the most fondly regarded by select horror fans. I'm one of them. Mad Men was back then and remains now one of my personal favorite slasher horror movies. Now, in a nutshell, it's the tale of the counselors and the youth leaders at North Sea Cottages, a summer camp for gifted children, whatever that means. And the camp has a really interesting layout, by the way. I like the way the buildings are all set out. I like the feng shui of the place, if you want to call it that, even though it facilitates carnage. But anyway, this camp, we find it, it's the last night of camp before the parents come up, and so the head counselor, Max, is sitting around the campfire telling everybody a freaky tale of a local killer who stalks the woods. Yet, it's very similar to the opening to The Burning from 1981, since both films took their inspiration from the Cropsey urban legend. But there's something very cool, and I would say even cooler, about the way the campfire tale is presented here in Mad Men. As Max talks of a brutal local man from history, we see shots of a heavy-booted farmer swinging his axe as he walks his house, and we see a spooky old farmhouse in the midst of the woods. It's all lit in what genuinely looks like pure moonlight. And this farmer is a horrible guy to start with. He beats his wife, he's horribly harsh to his children. But then one night, Max explains that he went crazy and he murdered his family. Now, this idea of someone just suddenly flipping and going crazy freaked me out when I was a kid. It reminded me of Ray Bradbury's The Martian Chronicles. That's a great book, of course. And I'm one of the few weirdos who actually loves the TV miniseries based on it. But I always remember the character of Jeff Spender, played by Bernie Casey in the miniseries, who's so disillusioned with mankind and so fascinated by Martian culture that he flips and he murders his fellow astronauts on the Martian surface. And after it happens, he says to Captain Wilder, "Just think of me simply as a man who went mad once summer's day." And it's a chilling idea that one person can flip a mental switch and can completely change their moral behavior within a moment. And here Madman does just that. Though, to be fair, he's already a nasty piece of work, so they make the point in the script here that he doesn't just have a nervous breakdown, but he goes stark raving mad, and I quote that. As soon as Max starts to say these words, stark raving mad, Mars walks, you see Madman walking into a room, a low squelchy synth kicks in, and I can remember how much that image chilled me. This combination of him going mad and then the shot of him walking through his room and the squelchy stinger on the synth soundtrack. Anyway, it ramps up the scary intensity too because he chops up his wife that night, and not only chops her up, but chops her up into little pieces like it took him a while. But then he adds this point as well. Max says, and now with his bloodlust awakened, and it's like, this weird farmer has this pent-up violence that's finally splurged out on this weird night, and he loves the fact that it's coming out of him. He's rejoicing in it. That's a scary setup for a murderer, the mad farmer, who suddenly feels alive in his spirit because he's drenched in the blood of his wife. I mean, come on, that is a frightening idea. I think it's this notion of this farmer suddenly going mad, which is disturbing, especially when you think about the reality of farmers these days. Here in England, it's a notoriously difficult and stressful profession, but across the world, big business is squeezing farmers' profit lines to unsustainable levels, and it's long been known that farmers have one of the highest rates of suicide in the world. In a recent article in Newsweek, it even called these suicidal farmers an international crisis. Now, this idea of frustrated rural folk being turned to mental despair is a disturbing one, and it's one of key ideas in certain horror films like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, where we get abattoir workers gradually going insane in the backwoods of Texas, only for city dwellers to wander in and fall at their mercy. Now, obviously, I'm not suggesting the farming community are all ripe for turning homicidal, but the factual reality of suicidal farmers finds its natural expression in horrors, where the farmers aren't so much suicidal, but they are homicidal instead. And Madman stomps through the rest of his house, murdering his son and daughter in moments that are reminiscent of Amityville 2, The Possession, which, if you've seen that, you'll remember it depicted the real-life case of Amityville killer Ronald DeFeo. None of the family in his case, and also none of the family in Madman's case, seem to notice as the other members of the family are killed in sequence. And so you wonder, is there something supernatural going on? Has the family not just gone mad, but is something making this happen, something facilitating it? It appears so, because the mad farmer rocks up at the pub afterwards and orders a beer, sets his bloody axe on the bar like it's his car keys, and then 10 other farmers meet out a little small town justice and go to execute him for his crimes. We get a similar, though much heartbreaking, version of this in the previous year from the excellent TV movie Dark Knight of the Scarecrow. Anyway, they leave the madman for dead, but the next morning he's gone. And what's more, the bodies of his wife and children are missing too. And you're thinking, what the heck is going on in this farmer's head? I mean, he can't be hiding the bodies to escape the law, because he's already been accused and sentenced, as it were, for this crime. So you're wondering, does he feel guilt? Does he want them back, to be back with his kids and with all those tiny pieces of his wife? Or is Madman racked with remorse and he wants to take out his anger for his night of madness on the rest of the world? Or, of course, maybe he's just totally messed up and loved killing his family so much that he wants to be able to view and see his work like the trophy collecting habits of some serial killers. In short, this is a setup that I think is loaded with grim themes and intense ideas, which makes The Legend of Madman really quite twisted indeed. And I think it's one of the reasons why the film struck a chord with so many viewers, particularly people of my generation who were kids when they first saw it. It's a very dark legend. But of course, he's still out there looking for fresh victims, which is where the cool urban legend idea comes into the film. It turns out that Madman might be blind in one eye, but he has a seriously good hearing ear, because if you say his name above a whisper, he'll hear you from where he is and he'll come for you. And we finally discover his name is Madman Mars. So named by producer Gary Sayles after Mars, the bringer of war from Holst's Planet Suite. Now, this saying a name to invoke the monster is a preempting of the whole Candyman sort of repetition that made him appear in that film. But of course, it's also reminiscent of the folk legend of Bloody Mary, who'll appear if you say her name three times into a mirror, and maybe she'll show you the face of your future husband. What I always found so scary about the Madman Mars idea, though, is invoking him would be so easy to do by accident. At least with Candyman and Bloody Mary, there's a sense of repetition involved. With Mars, you could just run into him merely by accidentally saying his name slightly louder than you wanted to. You know, I can vividly remember me and my sister watching this and saying his name quietly after the film, just in case, you know. Like, she was probably just going along with it for a laugh. She was older than I was the youngest in the family. But I always remember in the back of my mind wondering, what happens if Madman Mars is actually real? And what if I say it out loud, will he come for me? And even now, right, I'm not even kidding, this kiddified urge not to say it too loud is still in my brain here. 30 years later, I've got to give kudos to a film that makes me feel that. In fact, I remember I started to refer to him as Madman Marzipan with my sister whenever he cropped up in discussion, because at least that way you weren't saying it in proper risk. But then I was always in doubt, what if he really hears? Well, look, it's 30 years later. I'm a grown-up now. I think I can get away with doing it. So here we go. Madman! Madman Mars! Maybe I shouldn't have done that. Anyway, once this legend has been delivered, then of course someone decides to test it out, and so we get wise guy Richie, who starts shouting Madman Mars really loud like I've just done, and even throws a rock into the woods, which somehow smashes through the window of Mars's house. Now, whether this is some weird supernatural space bending going on, or the house is literally right there, it isn't really clear. Or maybe Richie has just got an amazing pitching arm. Either way, the name is said aloud and the rock cracks through the window, and then boom, cue the slasher squelchy bass notes, Madman Mars has been duly summoned. But it's worth pointing out that it's not all Richie's fault. You see, during this whole scene, the storyteller Max himself quite openly says the name above a whisper. He even shouts it out when he tries to placate Madman Mars, and then in an interesting moment, which ties into a theory that I'll share at the end of this, he says to this group of campers, be careful in the woods tonight. Why? Because, and they all say, Madman Mars will get you. So they all say it out loud. So effectively in that moment, according to the film's logic, they have all sealed their fates. Mars is coming now for every one of them, or at least the senior campers. Which is essentially what the film is. It's the senior counselors getting gradually picked off by this mad farmer invoked by this legend. Now, there are many people who say that the film sucks. I read a review of it the other day that said that it was utter dross. Others call it boring and predictable. It's been called unremarkable by the website AllMovie. They say only genre completists with completely undiscriminating tastes are likely to be frightened or entertained. I mean, sheesh. One of the reasons for this dislike for Madman is the fact, in one sense, it really does seem blatantly ripped off from Friday the 13th. Lots of slasher movies had already tried to emulate the vibe and setting of that film by setting the mayhem in a summer camp. So when Madman came along, I guess at first it really did just seem like a photocopy of all that came before. Indeed, there's even a scene where Betsy, played by Dawn of the Dead's Galen Ross, she's in a room where in the background we see Madman Mars shimmer out of the shadows over her shoulder, very much like the iconic scene in John Carpenter's Halloween. Yet to me, all of these blatant nods to other films never really feel, at least to me, cheap or derivative. I mean, maybe some people might think that, but I'm quite happy to take them on their own merits. And dare I say it, while I really enjoy Friday the 13th, there's something about Madman that just works a bit better for me. Look a little closer at this film, and I think you'll see a well-crafted, exciting horror film with moments of surprising humor. For example, some of the dialogue exchanges between the counselors is absolutely hokey, I know, but there's something just likable about it, about the way they all kid each other and do their best to be responsible leaders at this camp. So much so that, unlike many slasher films, I did actually care about these people once the axe starts swinging, and the axe certainly does start swinging. Not least the character of TP, who's a bit of a horror icon himself, at least in the cult slasher world. He's played by Tony Nunziata, who I'll talk about more at the end. But he looks here a little bit like the Christian evangelist J. John. Anyway, Tony really shines in this role and just stands out as a key element to the film's strength. He looks like a cocky, sort of slick Italian crooner who's a bit of a ladies' man. He's like a sort of slasher movie Fonzie. And he's also a bit of a modern guy as well. In one scene, he's just had an argument with his girlfriend Betsy, and he does a sort of public apology to everyone in a very new age, own your pain and share it sort of way, which is popular at the time, at least at the end of the 70s and early 80s. He's just a cool character who everyone looks up to, and you feel that, and he's got a great screen presence. He's also a key factor in the funniest scene in the film, where TP and Betsy get it on in the hot tub. Now, I remember being really embarrassed and awkward about this scene when I was watching it when I was younger. But watching it now, it's just so funny. I mean, they just sort of swim around this hot tub, gazing at each other and smiling inanely. And usually in genre pictures, if anyone's going to get naked, you're going to get the actress or a body double of the actress, you know, taking a top off or something. But in another unconventional move in this film, you get something else instead. You get a gratuitous shot of TP's outie belly button and then a lingering image of his hairy ass as he climbs into the tub. All the while, you know, Tony and Nunziata is crooning some love ballad over the soundtrack. The build-up to this sex scene is hilarious, and it's kind of innocent and sweet too. But not only are the characters likable and fun, but the film, I think, also manages to do something that's not always present in slasher films, and that's to be quite eerie. I mean, yes, it's got the gore and the violence as you'd expect from the genre, and some of the kills in this are classic. The car bonnet death was kind of etched onto my terrified kid consciousness, but it also features one of the most realistically acted hanging scenes I think I've seen, largely because the actor in question, I won't tell you who to avoid spoilers, but that actor apparently let himself choke in real life, and it certainly works. The guy looks like he's gonna die in any second. It's very effective and dangerous looking too. So yeah, there's the skull-cracking, neck-splitting gore of early slashers you would expect to see, but there's also a sense of creepiness too. Many fans often say one of the most spooky moments of the film is where we first get a glimpse of Madman in the present day. Straight after the campfire tale, Richie, remember he's the one who shoots his mouth off challenging the legendary Madman Mars to show himself. And straight after that, Richie sees Madman up in the trees and it's a silhouette against the blue of the night sky. And at first you can't tell if it's branches or a person, but there's wisps of grey hair blowing in the breeze, and it's a crucial image for the film and cements this sense of creepiness as well as violence and shock. I mean, can you imagine seeing that at night walking in the woods? By moonlight, you saw a mad farmer standing up in a tree watching you? I mean, jeez, that's scary. Now, not only is this spooky lasting image like this one, but there's lots more, I think. There's the shot that made the poster of Madman's silhouette stomping into camera holding his axe, as well as the axe swinging walks from the campfire tale I mentioned earlier. I actually think the cinematography in this is really quite decent. Oh, and there's also a brilliant shot of Madman holding up one of his victims aloft with his bare hands. You know, you think, crikey, this guy is strong. And the filmmakers rammed the point of his strength home with repeated shots of Madman putting out candles with his bare palm like a badass. And Mars also is the only one in the story who can manage to pull an Excalibur-style axe out of the tree trunk it's been embedded in. So all these little touches are quite cool. As well as eeriness, there's also a good sense of pace and suspense too. There's a scene towards the end of the film, for example, when one of the counselors is rushing away from Madman, although she smiles a lot for some reason. She's got a funny smile on her face all the time. Anyway, she has to hide in a fridge while he's stomping around outside, and it's genuinely a tense moment. The late director, Joe Giannone, is that how you say it? Anyway, he pitches it perfectly, in my opinion. This scene's also one of the examples of how the film is quite generous with its focus. You could argue that Gaylen Ross is the heroine of the film, but the film doesn't always follow her constantly. Instead, we find that the action shifts from one group to another so that the characters get a decent amount of time to not only be introduced, but also to be tracked down and dispatched in various imaginative set pieces. It's a sort of ensemble feel that I thought anyway. It's also worth flagging up how the film ends. It's a different sort of ending, a quite novel ending for a slasher film. I'm not going to say how it differs from the formula, but it does and is all the more refreshing for it. Now, one of the other things that make the film stand out is at least to me, is that it feels surreal. It's a little left field, this film. There's something about the way it's put together that to me feels quite dreamlike. For a start, everything happens at nighttime. There's not a single shot in the day, which really ramps up the claustrophobic atmosphere. But there's also the fact there's only about 5 kids at this entire summer camp. So they're outnumbered by the counselors. I guess this was some sort of budgetary restraint or constraint, but you see a film like The Burning or Sleepaway Camp and the place is teeming with kids, teeming with extras. Here though, the kids are so sparse and immaterial in some ways. I think it just adds to this weird dreamlike atmosphere of this camp. There's lots of other quirky aspects to the film which in my opinion add to the vibe of dreaminess rather than detract. There's the fact that the house of the killer is literally within a stone's throw of the campfire, which just feels ridiculous when you think about it, but it's strangely acceptable in the dream-like world of Madman. There's also the fact that two of the women characters in this don't seem to trust their vision. They both see Madman really blatantly, but they quickly question themselves and decide it's nothing. And you're like, what is wrong with these people? Like, they've just seen a crazy killer. Is this just a silly plot hole? Or is it some sort of clever supernatural spell that this demon-haunted farmer can cast on his witnesses? Who knows? Then, of course, there's the music. Or more specifically, the songs. Well, the music, the score is great. I want to get that someday. I think Death Waltz might be releasing it. But the film also has a bunch of songs, one being the love song I mentioned earlier, sung by Tony Nunziata in the hot tub scene. But it's the song at the beginning and the end of the film that add the real sense of surrealism to the film. You see, it doesn't just open with the head counselor, Max, telling a scary madman tale. Just before it, preceding it, TP does a sort of musical version of it called Song of the Fifth Wind, where he vamps around the campers, gurning and singing about bodies never found. And intricate with this are actual scenes from the film of the characters being stalked and killed. And it's like a weird little prophecy of what's going to happen in the film, and it's quite unusual. It's not unheard of. You get a similar effect in Joe Dante's genius werewolf film, The Howling, where you get snippets of film dialogue played over the credit sequence. But here we see actual images from the upcoming movie of characters in peril. And you'd assume that seeing information like this in the first 5 minutes is going to rob the film of suspense, but it does really the opposite in a way. It's a slasher movie after all. You know people are going to die, but the blatant overture of that at the start is an unusually brash and visual way of doing it. Now, linked to this weird topsy-turvy approach is this title sequence of the film, which is a brilliant black-on-red graphic of a twisted wood designed by Paul Ehlers, actually the actor who played Madman himself. And there's the scary, harsh synth stab that squeals when we see the Madman title shoot out of the screen. I really need to get that sound as a notification of a text message on my phone. Anyway, we get that sort of rolling credits that usually happens at the end when the words go up, but it happens at the very start of the film. And you wonder, what the heck's happening here? Like, is this film a little bit like the Videodrome theory I shared last episode, where Madman could be another film that's cyclical? It's a constant cycle, a constant loop, a nightmare loop where the film showing a doomed night never to be escaped from. Who knows, maybe the film is in itself a legend that keeps on getting told and retold. The legend lives and lives and lives and lives. Another unusual touch is that after TP finishes his scary song, Max then effectively tells a more straightforward prose version of it. The presence of these two alternative tellings together feels like something I would have thought a big studio would have cut. They'd have said, just have one or the other. I love how Madman just puts them both in straight away, and you get an atmosphere that things are a little bit unpredictable and a little bit unusual and off kilter. When the ending does finally come, we get the truly iconic song, where it turns out that the film has an actual theme song. Just as the credits start rolling, you hear this odd clomping synth while the vocals sing, "Beware, beware of him, beware the Madman Mars." And there's some people who would just roll their eyes at this bit and think, oh my word, this is ridiculous, it's got a song. I remember thinking that at the end of Stephen King's Cat's Eyes. I was squirming when the 80s pop song kicked in. Cat's Eye, how you took me unaware. Even though I think it's sort of quite fun now. But for me, the folksy synth mashup of Madman's song just puts the film in more of a dreamlike state and just think, wow, I love this film. The song itself certainly lives on. Just check out the amount of cover versions out there, including one by yours truly. Do check that out too. Now, who is Madman Mars? Well, I have a theory about that. I'm not sure if this theory has been on the commentaries or is already out there already. Maybe it is, because it seems a bit obvious to me, but maybe it's not. But just a thought I had while I was watching this. Is Max, the senior counselor who tells the tale, is he Madman Mars? Now, bear with me a second. I mean, you never see him in the same shot. And he tells his tale at the start, almost willing the kids to shout out the name and get the homicidal ball rolling. Remember, he gets them to shout the name out nice and loud. He also is a big guy with long wispy hair. It wouldn't really take him long to pull on a crazy mask and climb up a tree as the young kids head back to their camp. You know, I just thought maybe it's him. Just a thought. I quite like the idea that Max is this crazed maniac who's just waiting for the last night of camp to unleash his fury on these campers he's been looking after all summer. And think of his name, Max. That's only a couple of letters off Mars, isn't it? Well, okay. Besides, even if Max isn't Madman Mars, there's still something questionable about Max's sanity. He tells these kids an uber-violent horror story at the start of this, which Betsy is disgusted with and calls him out for. But afterwards, after he tells this horror tale of a mad farmer axing his family, he literally says to them all, "I hope you enjoyed my little story. It's my way of saying goodbye." and good luck to you children. And you think, wow, how does this guy tell his wife he loves her by showing her a car crash or something? He's really intense. Anyway, hopefully by now I've pointed out enough left field approaches to the film to show you that I think it's unfair and way too hasty to write Mad Men off as a pure generic ripoff. The slasher wave of the early 80s may well have been huge, but while this gets drowned out for many viewers, it's a key slasher title for me. I think it's both refreshing and intriguing. It's scary, it's got an interesting main villain, and while it's obviously lost on some people who think it's moronic, there are legions of horror fans, myself included, who see something special in the way it's put together. I'm not sure what it is about Mad Men that makes it so likable, but it just is. Maybe it's nostalgia, maybe it's the age I first saw it, or maybe, just maybe, it's because it's actually a lovingly made, interesting, creeping, pleasing, and at times, unconventionally conventional slasher film. So how's Mad Men fared on this new Blu-ray from Arrow? Well, picture quality-wise, it's a new 4K transfer that might lack the crisp resolution of their recent Videodrome release, for example, but for a low-budget film set totally at night, the results are actually really good. There's inherent issues with the negative, and they crop up now and again, mainly a sort of strange reddish streaking down the center of the screen like that, you know? Ironically, it looks like Freddy Krueger must have, you know, scraped his glove down the center of your TV. But that's not often, it's not that big of a deal. And yes, there's a bit of grain and softness here and there, but on the whole, it's a great leap up from the VHS and DVD editions that you might be used to. Now, if you've got the latest Vinegar Syndrome release of this on Blu-ray, then the extras are pretty much identical and the print is very similar, though I've read a review that says Arrow's presentation's got slightly better edge when it comes to skin tones. I'm not really sure, I couldn't compare. I don't have both issues. But what's great is, for me, this is the first time I've been able to see these extras that have been around for a while already. So I thoroughly enjoyed the fan-made feature-length documentary, Mad Men, The Legend Lives, which interviews key members of the cast and crew, with the sad exception of Galen Ross. I wish he'd been in it. And also, it's got my favorite moment, when the producer Gary Sayles and Mad Men actor Paul Ehlers revisits the original woodland location of the film, and they stumble across the actual chain and rope hookup they used in the movie for the hanging scene. And you can just see like how thrilled they are to find this 30 years later. And it's great to think of it. It's probably still there now, swinging still as I speak. Though one wonders if some unscrupulous Mad Men fan might slink out there in the middle of the night and cut the thing down for their collection. There's certainly plenty of hardcore Mad Men collectors out there who might be eager to do that. There's a couple of commentaries on the disc, which I haven't been able to listen to in time for this, but I will be. And other extras on there too. So in a way, you're going to know all there is to know about Mad Men once you've worked your way through the disc. Though I do wish Arrow had added a few exclusive extras as well, but there you go. One final note is that the film has an in memoriam to the director Joe Giannone, and also to Tony Nunziata, I've mentioned earlier, who plays TP. Now, I mentioned about Nunziata being really great in the role of TP, and what's surprising to find is that this was his only film role. His main job was actually being an expert in fish, and he was the director of the Sardine Museum and Herring Hall of Fame in an island just off Maine. Now, this was home to the world's largest sardine can, and he used to run this place, and so he was known for his fish expertise so much that he's actually credited as Tony Fish in Mad Men rather than Tony Nunziata. Now, sadly, Tony died really young, aged only 51 in 2009, but it's very clear from the extras on the Blu-ray that he was a well-loved man, and while Tony was well-respected by people in the world of fish and tourism, of course he was, his worldwide fame undoubtedly comes because of Mad Men. I know him because of Mad Men. And this is something I notice. So many actors are fondly remembered across the world, not because of some high-profile drama series or an amazingly well-received theatrical career, although those are all important things, but it's often because of their presence in genre movies. I love the irony that films seen as cheap knockoffs jumping on a genre bandwagon are sometimes more meaningful to people decades later than the massive and worthy blockbusters that perhaps they wish they could have been in, but many people have forgotten. Tony Fish and other actors and crew in Mad Men are great examples of how spending a few months of their life in a low-budget horror movie has cemented them into the core cultural memories of many, many people around the world. Now, and I appreciate this might sound a bit weird, but part of my faith as a Christian is that God calls me to respect and appreciate other people, particularly those people who are outside my own circle, as it were, who are different from me, or I don't know very well. And one of the things about horror which touches me is that I see this happening all the time. Horror fans show a cool sense sense of respect and support to people who are in their seminal horror films. These people might be older, even elderly these days, not do any more horror stuff, but there's something about these people who are constantly and always will be cool. There's this sense of respect and interest from the fans of horror, which I think is really cool, really meaningful. I like it. It draws unlikely people into community, which, speaking as a Christian, can only be a good thing, even if the connecting tissue is a tale of a homicidal farmer who chops his family up. That's okay, because we know it's fictional, and we know that at the end of the day, horror is about people. People making films and people watching films. People who are ordinary and straightforward in so many different ways, but just find themselves drawn into the world of scary make-believe, and for whatever reason, they make connections because of it. Madman's a great example of a bunch of likable people getting together to make a film that might have had some really harsh critics. But the fans of the film want to make it clear, I think, to the makers that what they came up with wasn't dross to some, but actually was a very meaningful experience. And the power of that legend, the Madman Mars legend, does indeed live on. Well, that's it for the Flicks the Church Forgot this time. Please do subscribe for more videos and check out the website for a whole bunch of audio podcasts. And do follow me on Twitter at RevPeterLaws or get in touch. But until next time, do not say his name above a whisper. And mind you, I did and nothing really happened. What was that? If you're in the woods tonight, just remember, don't forget the Flicks the Church Forgot.